This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
You never really know someone until you find out what they've buried. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer.
We're talking about Brian Koberger today, and we're going to dive into the legal investigative storm surrounding him. The criminology PhD student accused of the shocking murders of the four University Idaho students. This case has captivated the public, not just for the brutality of the crime, but for the complex web of evidence involving DNA, digital footprints, and forensic breakthroughs like investigative genetic genealogy. It's called IGG, and that's what we're going to be referring to quite a bit. I'm not going to say it the whole thing every time. The defense is fighting tooth and nail right now to exclude critical evidence, IGG, raising the stakes for both sides in what's shaking up to be one of the most high-profile trials in recent history. Joining us is retired FBI Special Agent and host of the podcast, Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer on both YouTube and wherever you get podcasts. She's bringing invaluable insight into the investigative techniques and challenges at play here. Jennifer, with the defense targeting the DNA and digital evidence in this case, what does it tell us about the strengths and possible vulnerabilities in the prosecution's approach to the Koberger case?
Well, when it comes to the IGG in this case, which is the DNA evidence that links the sheath that was found below Maddie Mogan to Brian Koberger, this is the huckleberry. This is the most important piece of evidence in the entire case, hands down, and the defense is taking a shot at it. And recall, they've done this before. Actually, everything we're seeing now, we are seeing it for the second time because they changed venue and Judge, who was the previous judge, has stepped down. So we have a whole new Judge Hippler, mm-hmm. Not Hitler, Hippler.
Hippler, yes. Very important P.
That's right. Well, that's the joke, right?
Yeah.
They're calling him that because he's much stronger of a presence than Judge. You know, we're seeing everything with timelines, and he's only giving them certain latitudes, meaning the defense. So it's shaping up much differently. I keep wondering if they don't regret asking for the venue change.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, Tony, this was all visited before in another hearing that lasted so long because mm-hmm. the defense called three different witnesses that they paid, three different experts. And you may recall one expert changed her mind and said, I didn't even sign that document,
mm-hmm.
The expert document. And another one was, I believe, actually a botany major, but had kind of gotten into IGG.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, it was very interesting. And then they also brought on board the defense a lawyer whose expertise is in the area of IGG, you know. So they have spent literally tens of thousands, let's say tens of thousands to be safe, on disproving the IgG information and basically disallowing it. And it lost last time, and I think it will lose their fight this time.
There's two fights. There's like kind of two ends to this fight that they're trying to make. One saying that it was gathered incorrectly, that it violated constitutional rights and privacy protections. The other end of it is arguing that it's not a reliable science. Let's first talk about violation of constitutional rights and privacy protections. There's not a whole lot out there that really defines how you can get it, how you can't get it, how you can use it, what it's used for. It's just kind of out there. So it's kind of the Wild West in some ways. Do they truly have an argument that is going to stand up that says, yeah, this there's a certain way of gathering this and you didn't do it right. So because of that, baby's out with the bathwater.
I just don't think they have the legs to stand on. They've tried to stand on some legs here and tried to build that case, and it's just not provable. When you look at the DNA that was collected, which is touch DNA, which for everybody, that doesn't mean you just touch something. Those are actual skin cells from your body that are left on a particular item, and it usually involves a lot of friction to even leave such cells. It's very rare for you to just touch something and have your skin cells slide off. In this case, it was the clasp of the K-bar knife sheath, and that makes a lot of sense for anybody who has handled a K-bar knife sheath. The snaps are very hard to open for obvious reasons. You don't want your knife being loose and you go to grab it and you cut yourself.
Yeah.
Or it falls out and you grab it. So they are tighter than really almost any other form of snap that I've ever dealt with, the knife sheath snaps. So in any event, that's where this DNA was retrieved from. Obviously, it was retrieved below a murder victim. So there certainly is no privacy or issues with that collection point. Mm-hmm. Then they used IgG, which is essentially comparing, and this is where it gets dicey, right? They're comparing it against all these databases where people want to know what their lineage is. Mm-hmm. So they send in their DNA, they swab themselves and send this in, and there's these huge data banks with basically, you know, millions of people's DNA. Mm-hmm. And from that, you can link to other individuals. And that's exactly what happened here. They initially linked it to the father's DNA. I have to be careful how I say that because I've been, you know, called under the carpet for how I'm saying that. But basically, there were DNA characteristics that matched up to the father then. Once they were able to identify and get samples of Brian Koberger's, then they could compare it for the 100% match, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, it does. I mean, basically, they got the initial one. They discovered, okay, this links to this very specific family member. It's very likely that someone close to this person is the match to the knife sheath, which then led them towards Koberger. Then they eventually did do that swab of Koberger, and then they matched it. And yeah, surprise, surprise, it's him on the knife sheath. That being said, pretty factual. Like, there's not a lot of room for error here. There's not a case where, oh, shoot, it's somebody else's DNA, but it showed up like yours. Like, the odds of that are, like, in the billions. So it's not even really a thing. But they got there how they got there. So it doesn't erase the science. It doesn't erase the fact of what the DNA evidence is showing. The main argument does seem to be logistics on how you got here or how you didn't get here. And the thing is, IgG is used regularly in court. It's used by defenses. It's used by prosecution. It's kind of like whoever this makes the most sense to use it in, if they have it, they're going to use it. there isn't a whole lot of precedent here saying this isn't science or this is junk science, we can't take it. More so the precedent is going and saying, no, this is pretty factual on how it's working. Everyone's a bit uncomfortable at how it's being gathered because there's not a lot of strict protocols to this yet. Do we need to get more strict protocols on how this is used, or the fact that it's just kind of out there in the public, I mean, does that prohibit it, or should law enforcement have to go through a specific process to gather that information when they think it may be helpful?
Well, they do have to go through a process. In fact, these companies that gather this to help people figure out their lineage, they require search warrants and legal documents before they'll turn anything over. So it's not as if the government said, okay, you need to give me this. No, they had to go to a judge and actually get a warrant for this information for them to do the comparison. And I should say, and I think this is very interesting, when it comes to Brian Koberger, they actually had a warrant to search his mouth. Usually when you're arrested, and it's not every state, but usually when you're arrested, they are allowed now to swab you, just like we printed people. Right now, you can swab everybody. And pretty much everybody gets swabbed. There's a few states that don't, you know, require that. But for the most part. And they went above and beyond and said, we're going to do a search warrant for his mouth to swab him. I think just because they didn't want to have any sort of legal argument that could be posed regarding swabbing him. So the prosecution and I should say law enforcement has really gone above and beyond the legal requirements to obtain the DNA and to obtain the records pertaining to IgG DNA information. So I just think that this is the problem with the defense's argument. It's not there that I can ascertain.
Yeah. The fact that they're raising concerns about evidence contamination, about the IgG process and all of that, it really just kind of feels like they're throwing things at a wall and seeing what sticks. In your opinion, as a former FBI agent, and what we know about how this investigation went down, is there any red flags that you can think of or that you've seen so far and how they gathered anything or how this case has come together? Or has it been a pretty tight ship from day one with the investigators looking into Koberger?
I think overall they did really an excellent job. And I don't say that because I'm former law enforcement. I call out all the time situations that are just jaw-dropping. But in this one, they've done a good job. The only hearing that, and I've listened to all the hearings and gathered all the evidence I possibly can, obviously, with this is a very sealed case and very protected case. So it's hard to get your hands on everything. But there is one incident where one officer basically kept his information in his drawer related to a cell search. And now it was nothing, the interesting part of is it's nothing that was really mind-blowing. It wasn't about Koberger's phone or, you know, it wasn't, it didn't provide any very significant information, but you just never want that. He was on the stand and he felt horrible about it. You know, he's up there. I should have turned that in. Unfortunately, in cases that are large like this, with all this reports that are done. So every time, people might not know this, but imagine every time you open up that computer screen and you do any analytics on any cell data, and that's what this person did, they have to type a report on it. And then the next day, they do their analytics and then they type a report on it. So I believe there are dozens and dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds, of reports like this that are done. And this guy realized he left one of those reports in his, I think it was a, not his filing cabinet, but somewhere in his desk drawer, as I recall. And so, of course, the defense is going to make hay out of that. Well, what else are you holding back? And the guy immediately said, listen, I'm not holding it back. I just screwed up. Basically, I did an incompetent move. You know, we're all human, and he screwed up and didn't put it in the main discovery pile, if you will. So anyway, I have seen that. And then it just opens the door for the defense to say, is anybody else being, you know, holding anything back, whether accidentally or not accidentally? Mm-hmm. So you just hate mistakes to be made. That's the only one I know about.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. But obviously things do happen that really don't have a huge effect on what the information is that's going on within it. What's your thoughts on another piece of this case? Obviously, IgG and the DNA and all that is a big part, but what about his background? What about the things that we know about him, the fog, the brain fog, that mental fog, whatever he called it in his writings when he was younger, the getting fired from his teaching position, the fact that he was a PhD criminology student and was pretty far along in that. Do you think that those aspects, number one, are going to be allowed into the trial? And if they are, how could that benefit the prosecution, or could it also benefit the defense as well with just his experience and knowledge from an educational standpoint in criminology?
Well, I think when it comes to his background and all the issues that he had as a younger person, and that he wrote about his heroin addiction, beating his heroin addiction, his feeling that he just didn't matter, and just it paints such a horrible person, or a person that feels so horrible about themselves, and his, as you called it, I think it's actually called not mental brain fog, but visual snow.
Visual snow, yes.
Yeah, is what he suffered from. And what's interesting, just as a side note, Luigi Mangione also said he suffered from visual snow. Mm-hmm. And that's basically where you look out at everything, and it looks like our old-time television screens, Tony, where you had the antlers, or the antenna.
Yeah, the bunny ears, yeah.
And it would get snowy after, midnight, because there were no stations on. Mm-hmm. I think that really could actually play into the hands of the defense. I would really, in this case, be looking for, they can't make a mental, they don't have reason of insanity, but certainly when it comes to his sentencing, they can use that to mitigate if indeed he's found guilty. And I would be all over that. So I think down the road, all of that could be important. Will it be allowed in by either party for the trial? I don't think so. Maybe they'll be able to sneak it in. Mm-hmm. I think the prosecution will really just try to focus in on the facts. And I don't think, when I say the facts, the vehicle that was used, the cellular data, DNA evidence, I think they'll focus in on that and make their case this way. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to want to get into the mental hot mess that Brian Koberger, it would seem, was.
Less is more. In a lot of times, mm-hmm. because you get your point across, it's pretty solid. Don't add anything else in that could cause confusion to this case. I'm going to assume IgG will make it in and the DNA will make it in. If it doesn't, then that's going to be a whole other discussion. But let's assume it's going to be in there. I mean, they're kind of betting right now, or hoping that some of these things are removed to make their case a little bit easier to defend, other than just, hey, he likes to go look at stars, which seems to be where it's still at. That being said, do you think, and I know we're ways out from this trial starting, but I'm going to start to ask the question, if that's all they got, do you put him on the stand to try and get some sort of sympathy or empathy out of the jurors, that this is just a guy who has really, really horrible luck and he was just looking at stars and damn, this looks horrible, but he's not your guy?
This is my prediction, Tony. I think that the cellular evidence they are going to get from his phone and from his computers related to everything from Google searches to trial runs to impacting all the different places he went to. Mm-hmm. People call it stalking, but it's really not stalking. I've called it surveilling his targets. I think that is just going to really bury him. And I think that this stargazing, moonwatching defense is going to go right down, you know, not in a way they had hoped. So I don't think it's a good alibi. I've always said that. But, you know, he made a critical error in taking his cell phone and then turning it off.
Yeah.
It would have been much wiser to just leave it at the house. And this is part of the reason that a lot of apologists for Brian Koberger says it couldn't have been him. You know, they say, oh, no, he's a student, you know, a criminology PhD student. How in the world could he make all these mistakes? Well, he made the car. The car wasn't a mistake at all.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do? Steal one? You're going to rent one?
Yeah.
You're going to borrow one? Then you have more of a paper trail and more people being involved. So using his own car, I think, was actually the best choice he had other than running.
Mm-hmm.
Could have ran there. But I think it just wasn't conducive, you know, to being in the shape you have to be in then to commit that crime and too many issues running around afterwards.
Yeah.
you know, even if you discard your black outfit. So nevertheless, I don't think this is going to work. I think the defense was in a corner because they realized the digital evidence is so strong that he was out. They had to come up with an excuse as to why he was there. So it's a usual excuse, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you have great information like that, that puts them at a crime scene, they have to say, okay, or near a crime scene, they have to say why. And that's the best they could come up with.
Do you think these arguments are going to actually be raised in a trial, or once they get the signal that the DNA is staying in, that the IgG information is staying in, that all these things are trying to get rid of, the knife sheath, you name it, it's all going to be in there. Do we move to a plea deal at some point where it's like, you're not going to win this, let's just cut our corners or cut our losses and maybe you won't get executed? Do you think we're going to end there, or are we going to end with a trial on this?
I've really been thinking a lot about this, Tony, because I think one person that he truly looked up to, if you can look up to a serial killer, is Dennis Rader.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, Ramsland, who studied Rader so closely, the BTK strangler, was one of Koberger's instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And if he did look up to him, and I say this because their patterning is so similar, you know, they did both conducted surveillance of their targets. They both were very fastidious in choosing their targets and how they were going to conduct their crimes. I've always said, but for that sheath, law enforcement could still be looking for who committed this crime. Really, that was the big error that was made that cracked this case open. So if you look at what Dennis Rader did, he very suddenly, without really any reason, just pled. All of a sudden. So I'm guilty. And it was the reason was, I truly believe, is he enjoyed talking about what he did, how he did it. He loved to have that audience.
Yeah.
Of course, because once you plead, you know, you have all these investigators and profilers. Everybody wants to understand how anybody could do the horrific crimes he did.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this audience for so long.
Yeah.
Still has the audience, right?
Yeah.
So will Brian Koberger be like that, where he wants to plea and he wants to talk about it and he can't wait? Or will he be more like a Ted Bundy, where Ted Bundy fought it tooth and nail and then wanted to tell everybody about it, you
mm-hmm.
know, and dangle the carrots of, well, if you keep me around another year, I'll give you another victim location. Well, in both cases, law enforcement gets fed up with all of it and stops going to see them. And you know, obviously Bundy was put to death, but not Dennis Rader.
Mm-hmm.
He was not put to death. And
yeah.
And so I wonder if Koberger will follow in those footsteps, because I think he might have admired how he committed the crimes. And I say that because that's how That's how Koberger, you know, committed his crime.
I get it on his admiration from if you're want to be a serial killer and you're looking up to people who got away with it for a while, sure. But he doesn't possess the personality of Dennis Rader. He doesn't possess the personality of a Ted Bundy, at least as far as we've seen. And from the interactions we've seen and heard about when he was teaching, he was a very standoffish person. I don't think he really even wanted to necessarily be heard or seen. He seemed kind of like a very reclusive individual. And the other guys, not so much. I mean, once Dennis got his attention, he wanted his attention. There wasn't a lot of game playing here with Koberger. So that does make me wonder, you know, personality is one thing, but then looking up to somebody is another. Where will he fall in all of that once this, you know, gets towards a conclusion?
Well, you know, one of the things that I watched several times, and you may have watched it also, was the car stop. He was pulled over for an illegal turn. Basically, he got into the middle of the intersection, so when the light turned, then he could turn on red, right? A lot of people do that.
Yep.
And what I found interesting was the interaction with the female police officer.
Mm-hmm.
All the excuses. I mean, even saying that where he's from, they don't have rules like that, and they don't have, you know, just really making up a line of complete baloney trying to get himself out of this. And this was for a traffic ticket.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably all of, you know, $15 or $25.
Yeah.
And the lengths he went to his arrogance, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're talking about a traffic ticket. I understand. But you can learn a lot from somebody, how they act when they get their hand caught with the cookie.
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to act with a bigger cookie?
Yeah.
And so I always thought he would fight this to the end. So I guess if I had to make a prediction, I think he'll fight to the bitter end.
It'll be fascinating. Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
All right, true crime addicts, let's cut the crap. You're knee-deep in the gory details of your favorite podcast when suddenly a commercial hits like a bad meal. Seriously? You deserve better. Upgrade to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, where you can binge without those annoying ads. Plus, get extended interviews that go deeper into the darkness and early access to episodes so you can be the first to know. It's like trading up from fast food to fine dining, but with more blood. So, go ahead, search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and feast on the good stuff.